here for the WHFR Journal and the fall semester here at Henry Ford College.
Sounds great. We are so happy to welcome as our special guest today someone who has been at this college for many, many years, and that is just a wonderful thing, especially leading up to the new role that she has taken over here at Henry Ford College, and it is the one and only Holly Diamond. We love the name, we love the energy, we love everything about Holly, and so excited to welcome her on board for the first time on the WHFR airwaves in this new role as Vice President of Student Affairs. Holly has been registrar and about a million other things on this campus before. So we're going to focus on the new stuff because we know that everything she's done leading up to this has prepared her to be the very best for our college, for our community, and especially for our students here at Henry Ford College. VP of Student Affairs, that means it's, you know, the word student is in the title. Holly, we welcome you. We know that you share that joy of supporting students, and you do it every single day in your new role. Happy to have you here, and tell us a little bit about what's going on.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you, Alan. I'm excited to be here and excited for a new semester starting. And I love the energy, as Susan talked about. Every year, I get more and more excited. And over the last 2.5 years, it's been really difficult with the pandemic and not being able to see our students as face-to-face as we really want to. We've talked through a computer screen. And now, as you talk about welcome back days, we're really excited. We're going to be in person for some of that. And the things that are happening are, you know, just tremendous. We have complete, control versus what we didn't have during the pandemic. And so what we've been able to do is control hours a little bit better for our students. So you're going to be able to see in mid-September that student services and wraparound services will be available for our students in the evenings, which is something that didn't happen during the pandemic. So we'll be open until 6:30 in the evenings for those evening students or those students who can't get their services taken care of during the day. So we want to be there for all of our students because, you know, we know education is a choice. We know our students can go anywhere they want. They vote with their feet. And we're so grateful that they've chosen Henry Ford College for their education. And I think that, you know, by showing them our commitment to service, you know, we show our gratitude for them choosing HFC.
Yeah, Holly, you've been interim in this role for a bit, and I know that allowed you to sort of get your feet wet and transition over and so on. But how different is your job sort of day to day now that you are wearing the hat of vice president? You've been really dealing with the same kinds of things, but sort of from different perspective with registration and so on. It all boils down to student support, you know, and student services. But as VP now, how do you see your place at this institution for the impacting of our student population?
That's a great question and a great perspective to have. In my previous role, it really was about the service component. I feel like now in the vice president role, it is about the whole of the student, the entire student, the holistic approach to students, meaning that there is, you know, students are not transactional. Students are relational. And my vision really for everybody within student affairs and really the whole college is that we view our students as relationships. They're very important. They're not next in line or number, you know, ticket number two, ticket number three. We want our students to know they're people. They're important to us. And so what I'm seeing in this role is that I in my role have to approach this from a very holistic, overarching point of view, not from one silo, but looking at the whole student and making sure they're successful, whatever their goals might be. It might be a certificate or a degree or to transfer. And so whatever that goal is, we want to make sure we can help them achieve that through the work that our division and the whole college does.
And when we talk about that student experience, and we've, you know, at least I personally, you've been around the college enough, and I've thought about this, you know, it even going back 3 years, challenging enough as a non-residential campus, that whole question of student life and what the experience is when you come to campus. How do we even approach that here in fall of 2022? And I'm sure you've thought a lot about that as well.
You know, Alan, I'm glad to hear that you said student experience, because I'm really trying to focus everybody on getting away from the phrase student service. We want to service and be friendly, but the experience is most important. The experience of how a student feels when they're on our campus. And they should have that great feeling and feel like they belong from everybody from a building engineer to somebody in student services to the classroom. And we really, I'm approaching that from the standpoint of making sure those transactions are not transactions anymore, and that those interactions are now relationship oriented. And so, you know, if you remember many years ago, we had the tickets that the students would have to take, and no more tickets. We want to say, how are you, Henry Ford student, and what can we do to best serve you? Recognizing that we have different populations of students, and that we have to ourselves adjust to who those students are. It is not one size fits all. And that's something that I'm really working on getting everybody at the college to understand, is that one size service does not fit all students. One size interaction does not fit all students. And, you know, even operating hours, you know, that I mentioned earlier, does not fit all of our students. We must make ourselves ready for the students. We can't, you know, come in and expect students, you know, you be ready for us. No, students, we are here for you.
I love that concept of meeting someone where they're at versus where you expect they should be or expect them to be. And that is that's the service model that crosses, you know, a multitude of businesses and organizations. Certainly, it's just most aren't necessarily smart enough to tap into that to really ultimately have the most success. And when we talk about student success here in 2022, as Alan mentioned, it really does look very different. Success could mean helping someone get through a series of online courses or working, you know, in evenings here on campus for their education or different things like that. But when we define the concept of success for our students, what are we doing really well right now, Holly? What are some things that we want to continue to build on and do more of beside the idea of sort of retraining the mindset of what that service should look like?
I think we need to understand what success means, and it means different things to different students. And we can start this with the talk of the brand new strategic plan, which has four priorities, and they are success oriented. They are about access to education. That's priority one. Priority two, retention. Priority three, completion. Priority four, transfer. Those are all elements of success. And again, they do mean something different to every student. And so what's happening right now is that we have such a focus on our strategic plan and the student success component. Some of the things that, you know, in addition to what you said, Susan, in terms of retraining, you know, maybe our interactions, but we are taking really big steps by looking at realigning some services. So, you know, realigning things in the counseling and academic advising areas so that we are more student friendly, student accessible, and students don't have to wait for appointments, you know, because we do have some staffing sometimes, you know, can be short. And once we have a more full staff in the future, I think students will be really pleasantly surprised on the accessibility of staff members.
Well, that was actually kind of touched on my next question is sort of the challenges of, you can't be everything to everybody all the time. And certainly not just as an educational institution, but, you know, every business as well. You know, how to, you know, manage the concept of expectations versus, you know, the realities, I guess, on the ground. What you've seen so far and what you're, you know, above and beyond, you know, kind of like the dream end result of it, you know, kind of like how we get there.
Sure. You know, we know and we recognize that staffing can be an issue in many of our areas. And much like a lot of other business and industry, the labor markets have been difficult to hire. And so we're working on that right now. And Alan, you asked about, you know, how do we get there? We are engaged in pursuing a very substantial grant through some really, really fabulous donors that recognize the need to have students that reach their goals and that are successful. They believe in Henry Ford College. They believe in the education we offer. They believe in the services that we're delivering and the experience that we want our students to have. And they we're getting very close to hopefully being awarded a grant that will help us hire and bring forth more professionals that are able to help our students navigate the college system. The other component of getting there is we have a partnership with the state of Michigan, not a lot of people know about, and we are bringing in college completion coaches. And so they are not paid by Henry Ford. They're not Henry Ford employees, but they believe in education so substantially that they are here to guide our students kind of through the college process and connect them with those on campus who need them the most. For example, they will say, have you filled out your FAFSA? Have you filled out an application for graduation? You need a course substitution. Oh, let me connect you with a faculty member. And so these college completion coaches that we have are really phenomenal. And they bring that student in and then get them to all the important touch points on our campus. And as I've said, you know, it's the staff, it's our faculty, it's an administrator who might be able to help them. But we're getting there, Alan. We're slowly but surely we're getting there.
Well, and I've always thought, you know, us particularly at Henry Ford College, a kind of a unique campus and demographic, because some of those issues are academic based. Mm-hmm. Some of them are financial based. Some of them may be language based. We have a lot of different places to meet people when we say meet them where they're at. There's a lot of different starting points. And I know that for many colleges and universities or educational institutions, it's the same. But we've always felt that, you know, HFC in some ways is kind of a little bit different in that regard.
We are. I liken us to something, an experience I had when I came to the college. I felt when I got on campus, I felt like I was going to come here to get my experience. And then I thought there was another job in my career. But I got to the campus and it was different. It was amazing to me. And I felt like I was home. And I knew that when I got here, and I knew I'd be a lifer. So here I am 13 years later. And I feel like, you know, for our students, we are different. We do have some unique challenges that we face in terms of the need of our students. And we are working with an outside organization right now to revamp our emergency aid program. And so our students may know that as like the Hawk Strong or SOS, but we are working on a more elaborate and really well-rounded emergency aid program, recognizing life happens. And that happens to a lot of our students. And we want to be there to support them and keep them on that road to success.
Holly Diamond is joining us here on the WHFR Journal as we welcome our students back to the campus, whether literally or figuratively. School is in session, let's put it that way. And Holly, just recently watched your welcome back video that we have. If you want to see Holly and experience her excitement for what's happening, you can watch this 2-minute video talking about fall 2022 welcoming students. And that is right here on our website, hfcc.edu. Check it out. That's always a personal touch, and I love that. As Vice President of Student Affairs, Holly, we talk about the umbrella of responsibilities, and we've talked about a few different things that you are passionate about, that you're interested in doing and have your hands in. But we certainly know that it takes a village to raise a successful student. And that, of course, starts with the home and the support that the student has personally. Professionally speaking, what is your support network like? And how do you lean on your colleagues, you know, members of cabinet, et cetera, to do the best you can in your new job?
Wow, I love that question. I really rely upon mentors. And sometimes when you are in an administrative role, it's hard to admit that you don't know all the answers. And or you don't want to say that to your colleagues, and you don't want to say that surely to students, like, I don't have the answer. But sometimes you have to seek assistance from others who've been down the road, well-traveled. You need to talk to somebody who really can be honest with you. And I look to people outside of HFC and within HFC. But the people that I go to are the people who are going to resolve to be honest with me and really hold me accountable and say, no, I think you're taking the easy way out, Holly, or Holly, challenge yourself, challenge your college, challenge your students. So I feel like, you know, my path has, I've been very fortunate to have good mentors. I would not be here today if it hadn't been for people who took me under their wing, showed me the way, put me back on the path when I was off the path. And I feel like it's for me, that's something I want to give back to those I work with and our students. We all need that gentle guiding hand sometimes. And I feel like, you know, I was fortunate to have that for so long and still do, but it's time for me to share that with others as well.
Thank you. That's great. That's great. We have students that are interested in potentially, you know, wanting to do more than just take classes either on campus or online, and all of those extras that campus life can involve takes a lot of planning and a lot of time and preparation. And we talk about our Office of Student Activities. Alan mentioned the Welcome Back Days, which, by the way, I can give you that.
You got it. All right, good. Awesome.
Yeah. So it's the week of the 19th. So the week of September 19th, and there's events going on Monday the 19th, Tuesday the 20th, which is also National Voter Registration Day, and there will be activities going on as well. And then Wednesday the 21st. So 19, 20, 21. On Wednesday, that's our favorite day. That's the student clubs fair and student services event. There's some outside stuff, some inside stuff. And of course, WHFR will be there doing, playing some music and doing our recruiting, because our station is staffed by volunteers and community members, students of HFC. So again, 19th through the 21st. But when we talk about a vibrant experience, that classroom, that experience outside of the classroom, I'll put it that way, Holly, how do you feel we're holding up at HFC? And what would you say to students or parents of students, family members of students, to encourage them to, once they step outside that classroom, to maybe stick around for a bit and see what else we've got going on?
Yes, I would say my biggest phrase to parents and to students is get involved. Get involved. Find something that you're passionate about. And I'll give you just a great example. We have a new club that just started, and it's called the Competitive Gaming Club. It took some individuals who had a passion, some students who had a passion for gaming, who really were interested and said, HFC, you know, can we do this? You don't have this. So they were able to bring about a positive change through our student activities, and then bring some, it gave them experience in writing a constitution and writing bylaws, but also now we have this wonderful club. And so I really say to students, you know, please get involved, whether it is with clubs and organizations, or get involved. We have athletics, we have jobs on campus. We definitely love our student workers. And I started as a student worker, incidentally, at another institution. And so there's a lot to be said for student workers. There's a special place in my heart for them. But I think that the involvement is key, Susan. It really is.
And that involvement is, you know, is sometimes difficult, as I said, even in ideal times, when, you know, you have to come to campus, or especially now with students, some of whom, you know, take most of their classes online. So what's sort of like the first place to go to find if there's something that you're interested in, or if you mentioned the gaming club, if you want to make that difference, what are some of those first steps?
Great question. I would say that if students are interested in clubs and organizations, check out our website for student activities. You're going to find our clubs, our organizations there. If you're interested in a job on campus, career services is a great place. Both found on our website. You can talk to me, email me. I'm happy to talk with students who are interested in getting involved. If they're not sure right where they want to be, I'd be happy to meet with them, talk with them and or parents, help get them to the place that best fits them for whatever their educational or, you know, outside of the classroom needs are. And, you know, we have a great athletics program also, you know, if people are interested in that. So, I would just, you know, say reach out. The website, my office are great places to start.
Right. When we talk about opportunities for students, I think one of the most exciting and rewarding aspects of being an instructor is feeling like you're even, you know, you have them for that small amount of time, that you're making a difference, that you're planting a seed, that you are helping that movement forward. I have right here on my wall, taped up to my wall, I have a phrase that I just absolutely love. And I think it really speaks to the role that you have, Holly, and the work that you're doing. And it says, they may forget what you said, but they will never forget how you made them feel.
Yes.
Now, that could be intimidating to an instructor who's like, I have to teach them, you know, math or whatever. But it really is how they feel in the long run. That's going to be the thing that carries with them beyond, of course, the academics. But what do you think about that?
I love it. And actually, you can't see it, but I wrote notes to prepare for this chat today. And it is how a student feels about being at HFC. Mm-hmm. And it is how they feel. And it is just showing that you care, whether you're an instructor, you are somebody who is working in a building cleaning, you're somebody who is an administrator, you're a support staff member. It doesn't matter, you know, what type of position we have at the college. It's upon all of us to really share with students how much we all do care. You know, I also previously worked at private institutions, and so I have a different perspective of how things should go. And for me, you know, honestly, without students, we don't have jobs. And we are here for our students, and we should never forget that. And to me, I always want a student to know that they matter so much to me that I come to work every day to do my job for them, not for me, not for the paycheck, but for the students. And I would hope that they and their families know, because, you know, it's a family decision where you go to school and where do you attend college. And I want the families and parents and students to know that we all are here for them. And your saying is right, spot on, Susan. It is about how they feel, because it's also the same thing for employees, is how you feel about coming to work. And I feel great coming to work every day knowing I'm going to help make a difference in the lives of students in one way or another.
So as we're starting another semester and, you know, academic years, I guess, in general, what has that been like in terms of, you know, the number of students? Where are we? Are we trending great? What can we do? You know, I've seen the billboards and, you know, the banner ads and stuff like that on websites that, just for some reason I, you know, end up finding, you know, what has it been like and what the challenges are, again, kind of at this unique little point in time.
You know, we are, in terms of, you know, if we look at enrollment as compared to last year, that's what a lot of people ask me. How are we compared to last year?
Right.
Are a little down. However, I would couple that with saying, I watch the enrollment for all of the community colleges and four-year schools in the state of Michigan. And in terms of being down, everybody is actually, as of yesterday morning, everybody is down in, as far as community colleges goes. We are looking just about the best at in terms of enrollment is compared to any of the community colleges. So while it's not the best news to be a little bit down, it is great news that we are not down in double digits as many of our colleagues are at other institutions. It's a very unique time for higher education. And, you know, everybody is seeing a decline. You know, if you look at the institutions across the United States, people are experiencing great declines. You know, institutions that never thought they would see that are experiencing that. I feel like we are doing a great job. We've got a great team of people within enrollment services, student affairs, and throughout the college that work so hard. They come in extra hours, they stay late on their own, and they commit themselves to our students. And I feel like we're doing just about everything we can from a technology standpoint, you know, using technology to reach out to students, but also the personal touch of phone call campaigns, postcards to the home. One thing I would just say that is maybe of interest to students or parents, if a student has a debt with the college, I'd encourage them to call, because we have a new debt forgiveness program, and it may allow them an opportunity to return to college when they might not have been able to do that in the past.
That's very important to hear. And obviously that's been something that's been, you know, kind of in the news recently on a more national level. But to know that that program is here and available to them even right now at this moment as well. What would be a good place to start to get more information on things like that, just to help keep students stay on track? And I guess that's the end goal. That's when you talk about that experience and everything like that.
Yeah,
sure. I would say the best place really is the website, the hfcc.edu. And if they put in the search box, debt forgiveness or Hawk Pathways. And I named it Hawk Pathways because it is a path back to their success, a path back to their journey, a path towards their goals in life. And so if they just go to the website, put that in there, we have an outlined program. And then for those students who may not qualify, there is also a payment plan that our student accounts has recently designed that will allow a student to pay on their balance and continue to attend college. That is something that is very new for HFC, and in response to a lot of what we heard from our students, you know, our students saying, I need a payment plan, and we have a great payment plan for them.
I can think of two or three students literally right now in my head that I'm going to quickly email after our discussion. Say, give it a try. Come on, check it out. Because it really sometimes can be as you know, I was going to say simple. It's not simple, but as just one thing that's preventing somebody from getting back. They couldn't pay for something. There's something with something that some of us would be like, oh, we'll just take care of that. But if you don't know, and you don't know that those services are available, you're just going to stay put. And we want to, you know, it's a path. That means moving, you know, standing on a path. It's not a path. It's just it's a piece of cement or so, you know, we need to keep it moving forward. And Holly, you, in this new role, as Vice President of Student Affairs, it sounds like your mission is to keep moving students forward along that path. And so we are so excited to have you here and have you in this role. We didn't talk much about returning students or non-traditional students. There's, you know, so many students at our college are coming back for some retraining or coming back after many years in one, you know, career position, and now they want to do something else and so on. So we certainly welcome students of all ages and all places in their experience, which I suppose it goes to that sort of meeting them where they're at, wherever that might be. And what, you know, as we're moving here into the fall, what are some of, you know, your top priorities, to best support our students as we get ready to wrap up for today?
Sure. I would say for both our team members and our students, I want to have a campaign of togetherness. We are in this together. Students, we're in this together. We're here to move you forward, as we talked about, along your path, along your journey. And team members, we're here together. We are going through staff changes together. We're going through bringing new people in together, and we're going through educating our students together. I also, you know, really have been talking a lot with our team members and our parents and students about trust and respect. We ask for students to trust in us for their education. We need to also trust in them and give them respect for choosing HFC. And I ask again the same things of team members, you know, trust and respect with each other, because if we have that kind of harmony, the service or the experience that we give to our students is that much better.
Holly Diamond is the Vice President of Student Affairs at Henry Ford College. Obviously, a lot going on, and obviously not just with sort of the cementing of the new position, but also just the cycle of the year and everything that goes on when we come back to campus for a new academic year. We thank you so much for being our guest today on the WHFR Journal.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
I'm Alan, along with Susan McGraw. This is the WHFR Journal. Thanks for being with us this Friday afternoon. We'll be here until 2 o'clock. We do hope you're having a great day. Have a great weekend. And we'll see you right after this with more here on today's WHFR Journal. Here on the station, Making Waves.
Hit it! Na 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 na.
Hello, WHFR. I am the diva, host of Lyrical Infusion. I'm on Saturdays, now from 5 to 8 p.m. Yes, we have grown. So come on, let's spend some more time. Make a date with the diva, where each and every Saturday I bring the lyrics out to play just for you. Lyrical Infusion with the Diva, Saturdays 5 to 8 p.m. WHFR.FM. We make waves.
Are you a Dearborn resident 60 years or older? Did you know that you can take classes at Henry Ford College tuition free? Would you like to improve your computer skills, become an actor, an artist, or an auto mechanic, or enjoy one of 100 other classes? You could even find yourself on the radio like I did, and I did it tuition free at Henry Ford College. For a complete information and a list of classes, please visit our website at hfcc.edu.
Again, if we look at the reasons why conspiracy theories spread, they provide a sense of control. They provide a sense of identity. They provide an outlet for fear and anger of an unknown situation. And what you essentially largely have is people who are trying to regain a sense of power and control over their own lives.
You're listening to Viral Networks, a look at the current state of mis- and disinformation online with the scholars studying it from the front lines. We're your hosts, Emily Boardman and Deloy.
You just heard from folklorist John Lee, who has done fascinating historical research on how conspiracy theories spread alongside diseases.
Today we'll be talking about mis- and disinformation in public health. We recorded these interviews in the summer of 2021, when vaccination efforts against COVID-19 were slowing down and vaccine resistance was gaining steam, partially fueled by anti-vaccine conspiracy theories. Like John says, this certainly isn't the first time that we've suffered from a pandemic, and it's not the first time there's been an information problem around one either.
Emily, you studied public health communication in grad school, right? Does that influence how you think about these issues of mis- and disinformation?
Yeah, I did, and it absolutely does. Usually public health communication focuses on what we call health literacy, which essentially means we're trying to help people make sense of the health information that they encounter at the individual level and community levels. If we're successful, that means people can be better judges of whether that information is credible or not. As basically all of our guests on today's episode will tell us, it's really important to do this work on the local and the community levels, and it's been made way more complicated by how quickly and easily bad information can circulate on social media. You could say one of the big public health risks these days is that mis- and disinformation can spread like a virus.
We have a really exciting group of guests on today's episode. In addition to John, we'll be talking to Polina Colté, who is an ethnographer of mis- and disinformation on social media platforms, and to Dr. Fiani Insofor, a public health expert in Nigeria. On that note, let's dive into the belly of the beast with Polina Colté. She was a social scientist at the University of Washington at the time of recording. Now she works for Twitter.
My name is Polina Colté. I spent the majority of my time thinking about vaccines, both like before the pandemic and of course during it. And, you know, focusing on vaccine hesitancy and particularly the anti-vaccination movement, this is of course cannot be done without thinking about the role of misinformation in the way that digital tools, anything from Facebook, you know, web browsers, and particularly like communities that people coalesce and connect with, in which they share misinformation on, like that, the role of that in the way that people have made a decision, not just of whether or not to vaccinate their kids, but, you know, today vaccinating themselves for COVID.
Since 2015, Kalina has been doing ethnographic research on mis- and disinformation and Facebook groups and other online platforms, which means she goes into these groups and talks to people who are actively participating in them. It's a way to research social media discourse by first understanding the social and cultural context.
It's almost like going out in a neighborhood and talking with the people in a community, except everything is online.
Exactly. When she's observing and interviewing people in these groups, she isn't trying to change anyone's mind. She's trying to understand what kinds of conversations they're having and how they form conclusions using the information that they're encountering.
How much vaccine misinformation, how much does something spread? And the reality, if we say that, we actually don't really always know. There's a lot we cannot see, and it's not something that I necessarily always should have access to.
Kalina describes something tricky about her work. People spreading misinformation on social media platforms are good at developing techniques for evading automated moderation. Those very techniques make it hard for researchers like Kalina to keep track of exactly that misinformation content.
Right, so instead of saying the word vaccine, they might use like a vaccine or the syringe emoji, or they might use like the @ symbol for an A, or in a variety of different ways. And this is often because people are trying to avoid sort of algorithmic detection. And so this is just like one element or one behavior and sort of a learned behavior within these communities of how to avoid moderation. And, you know, that's not to say that this isn't like a behavior that's used in a variety of other communities.
What's changed and what in these communities? I mean, what's the growth been like? Has the narrative shifted?
Almost every narrative that we've seen about COVID and COVID vaccines, it's been all things that we've seen before. It's very little that's new. So you can imagine, like, say, issues about like, or, you know, a story about like a vaccine injury. We've seen a lot of vaccine injuries, things about VAERS, which is the Vaccine Adverse Reporting System, things about like, oh, we're worried about the money that pharmaceutical company's going to make, or like Bill Gates. Bill Gates was the hot potential bigger in the vaccine world prior to the pandemic. So, you know, a lot of these things were all like, yeah, I've seen this before. Here's a long history about it. Even more sort of unusual things like relating vaccines to anything from like the mark of the beast, or, you know, is there aborted fetal DNA in vaccines, or all these other like even more niche things. Like those are still things we've always seen before. These are all arguments. It's because there is like a large arsenal of arguments of like, these are all the dangers of vaccines. If you don't believe this one, here's the other one. And I've actually gone to these conferences in person and gone to these talks where people are giving lectures of how to convince your colleagues, your friends, your family to start questioning vaccines. And one of the techniques that's taught is like, if someone gets shoots down like one of your arguments, go to the next one if you can't argue that one anymore. And then you just keep going down your list. I would say the only thing that is new, which I thought was interesting that we've seen so far, is the blending of two different narratives. So there's the classic trope that vaccines will threaten your fertility in some capacity, either typically making you infertile is like the thought, but like a variety of other ways, like something threatens women's fertility. And that's like tied to a larger conspiratorial idea about like depopulation and things like that. But then you also have this another classic trope, which is the idea of vaccine shedding. The idea is that if you say get vaccinated, if I got vaccinated for measles, I am actually a danger to society because I can then spread measles in the first few weeks to other people. So it's not it's not the unvaccinated person that's dangerous, it's the vaccinated person that's dangerous. And so what got tied, interestingly, this year is combining these ideas of vaccine shedding to fertility, where like if I ended up getting near someone who is vaccinated, they are now threatening my fertility. They're going to disrupt my menstrual cycle. They are going to ruin something about my reproductive system just because I'm near someone else who's vaccinated. So it's combining those two, that's something that is a pretty new thing. We've been in an extended period of health crisis. This is a long period of crisis versus consistently being in crisis. I listen to the news every day. Every day I hear something about vaccines. It has given the opportunity for people within these spaces to evolve and develop and refine and change even narratives and blend them like this.
But Kalina made sure to emphasize during our interview that it's not just members of anti-vaccine conspiracy groups who are exposed to mis- and disinformation. It's all of us.
Kulina gave us an example of how health misinformation can cross ideological lines and evolve as a greater diversity of people become exposed.
Prior to the pandemic, so prior to 2020, there were actually a fair amount of anti-vaccination accounts and activists who were pro-mask, right? So the anti-mask thing was something that was new, and it was a major shift in sentiment and opinion on this, like, health product, this health item, this health behavior that was changed due to a variety of different, like, propaganda really early on into the pandemic. We see a variety of different types of, like, Instagram accounts that are not just anti-vax, but also anti-mask. And so you'll see ones that are like the health and wellness mom blog, which I think also got, it's getting a lot of traction in relationship to other conspiratorial stuff like Save the Children and QAnon. And that's like one type. But then you also will see ones that are like really just straight up absolute conspiracy, like everything under just some like really like way out there.
This makes sense, right? Vaccine misinformation would just stay put in Facebook groups of true believers, but it would seep out into other groups and conversations online as well. But why would that misinformation be appealing to people who are not in the anti-vax or anti-max groups?
That was one of our biggest questions for our next guest, John Lee. John is a folklorist, and he's been interested in tracking conspiracy theories on the internet for decades. We talked to John because we wanted to know why conspiracy theories are so appealing to people. His answer is that they're actually a version of something we've been doing for all of human history, telling stories.
Hello, my name is John Lee. I'm an instructor at Suffolk University, and I am the author of An Epidemic of Rumors, How Stories Shape Our Perceptions of Disease.
Published in 2014, John's book discusses the 2003 SARS epidemic and the different types of folklore, including rumors, conspiracy theories, and jokes that emerged during that period in time. Much of the work focuses on how folklore spreads via the internet. With COVID-19, history is repeating itself.
It used to be we only really studied oral narratives as such as we were studying stories. When we were like researching legends in the 1980s, we would just go out and interview people and say, what do you believe about this? But then the 90s came about and everything moved online and we had to modify our set of tools to look at what stories that people are passing from email to email or status update to status update.
As John explained to us, much of his recent work focuses on the spread of conspiracy theories online. John sees conspiracy theories as a version of legends, or stories that both the narrators and the listeners regard as at least partly fictional.
Legends are what we sometimes describe as negotiations of the truth. You don't even have to have a full narrative to have a rumor or a conspiracy theory. A legend is usually something of a full narrative, but in conspiracy theory, what you more often have are what we call kernel narratives, where you just say, Bill Gates is the Antichrist, or microchips in vaccines, which points to this larger story, this larger web that we have connected together or that conspiracy theorists have connected together. And the same thing can happen in rumor, where, oh, did you hear that X happens to this person? That's it. That's the entire narrative. It's very tiny, but it points to this larger reality. So legends, if you look at the nature of a conspiracy theory, that they mostly involve this large assemblage of previously unlinked domains. And once you establish a pattern in conspiracy theory of simply adding another domain to help make the larger conspiracy make sense, then it's easy to just simply plop in something like 5G that's new, or microchips in vaccines, or any other unfamiliar technology. And when you look at technology, it's especially the unfamiliarity of new technology that often makes its way into conspiracy theory and into legend as a whole, because people aren't familiar with it. And there's always a little bit of hesitation, fear, reticence as to what this is and how it functions. Like if you go back to the 1970s and 1980s, when microwaves were first introduced into the common house, folklorists collected a lot of legends about people who would wear lead vests while they're working their microwave, or a lot of legends about microwaves somehow damaging your DNA or irradiating you, simply because it was a new technology and people were unfamiliar with how it worked.
I would like to talk, because you had a book focused on the SARS epidemic, about the similarities and differences that you're seeing with the disease narratives from that time period and the COVID-19 outbreak.
A lot of them are almost exactly the same. Is it man-made or is it natural? Going back to 2002, 2003, in the early SARS outbreak, there were rumors in that early outbreak of it being a man-made virus. Again, one of the acronyms was Saddam's awesome retaliation strategy, that Saddam Hussein supposedly made it. There were other narratives that said that the FBI or the CIA had made it and released it on the world for various reasons. We have, in the current COVID outbreak, was it an accident release from this Wuhan lab where they were studying this, and whether it was purposeful or accidental. So the man-made nature of the narrative connects the two incredibly quickly and incredibly well. The same sort of conspiracy theory thinking in a lot of ways, some of that based around the man-made nature of the disease. Was this intentional, and who created it, and who was the target because of it? So certainly xenophobia and othering, this large sense of making it someone else's fault and pointing the finger, is incredibly common across epidemics.
Of course, when we interviewed John, we also wanted to know what was new in the COVID-19 era. No matter how much history is repeating itself, the internet has changed considerably since his study of SARS narratives.
I would say that social media is certainly exacerbating the problem, especially as it resorts to misinformation, conspiracy theory. Groups like QAnon, say, probably could not have existed 30 years ago, or if they did, they would not have been as widespread and as well formed as they are. Social media has allowed that group to come together in a way that it wouldn't have before. That certainly not only helps a narrative spread within a group of people who are likely to believe that narrative, because you are more surrounded by people who believe the same things that you do, but it also makes it much more difficult for a correcting narrative or for an alternate narrative to then come into that society, because there are more people there to reject the different narrative, especially if you look at some of the problems with trying to debunk narratives, which very rarely works. One of the reasons is that you have this group of people who now all believe the narrative. And if there are 10 of you or 50 of you or 100 of you on this listserv and you all believe this one thing, and someone else comes in and says, no, that's not true, well, you've got 10 against one or 50 against one or 100 against one. And it's so easy to push that person out and disregard the narrative that they are trying to bring in.
Given the history of conspiracy theories online, we wanted John's opinion on the World Health Organization's decision to deem misinformation problems around COVID-19 a, quote, infodemic. Here, John refers to WHO as the WHO.
In calling it an infodemic or a misinfodemic, the WHO is missing out on a large reason why these narratives spread in the first place, which is that people are trying to make sense of the world around them. And you have to start there. Again, if we look at the reasons why conspiracy theories spread, they provide a sense of control. They provide a sense of identity. They provide an outlet for fear and anger of an unknown situation. And what you essentially largely have is people who are trying to regain a sense of power and control over their own lives, because they are not being given the kind of information they need to move forward, or they reject the kind of information that we need to move forward.
But is there anything that we can do to reduce the amount of mis and disinformation around health that we're seeing today?
One of the only things that really seems to be effective in, for example, trying to make sure that people are going to get vaccinated, is not to try to combat the narratives directly themselves at a federal level, at a governmental level, at a national level, not even at a state level or a city level. You need to move it down to the community level, because anyone who does not believe that a vaccine is good for them
is not going to believe a medical official who comes on TV and says the vaccine is fine. Even if it's Anthony Fauci, they're not going to believe the president, especially if they didn't vote for that president. They're not going to believe the mayor, especially if they didn't vote for that mayor. The people they're going to believe are going to be the local leaders, church leaders, business leaders, important people in local communities who are known entities to a large group of individuals. So it has to be a bottom-up approach.
So far, we've been talking about anti-vaccine groups and disease conspiracy theories from a U.S. perspective. But these phenomena aren't limited to one place. Misinformation and disinformation are very much a global issue. And in different cultural contexts, the challenges of dealing with them are bound to vary.
Now we're going to take a look at health misinformation in Nigeria, the most populous country in Africa. The country has 36 states and, by United Nations estimates, has a population of over 200 million people. That's about two-thirds the population of the U.S. Our next guest is a public health expert in Nigeria.
My name is Ifeanyi Nsoffo. I'm a public health physician from Nigeria. I work with Nigeria Health Watch, a health communications and advocacy firm, and also EpiAfric, a public health consulting firm, both based in Nigeria's federal capital city, Abuja. You know, that health misinformation is as old as the country. I mean, growing up, we had all sorts of, misinformation about different health issues. But I think what has happened of recent is that because of social media, because of ease of access to internet, to information, this misinformation really take on a viral form. So over the years, people see health workers, from other countries that look different, that speak differently from them. And I think that for those who want to, perpetuate that falsehood of the international community trying to take advantage of us, they see that as a ready tool. And the commonest thing that you hear in addition to what you said is they want to, sterilize us. They want to reduce our population. That's the common thing that you hear.
Ifeanyi helped us understand the link between images associated with vaccination and common fears around fertility issues. He believes people designing public health messaging in Nigeria need to understand that as well.
What we tried to say there was that, when you have such imaging, people would on one hand, look at it as, look, after all, when our wives go to, take some contraception, they are injected, so who knows what you have inside the injection. They could have all sorts of, drugs that could cause, that could sterilize women in such medication. And because of that, when you're coming up with graphics and messaging for COVID-19 vaccination, it's very important to run away from such kind of graphics because, of what it will connote, for people. That these guys have come again. And I think because if you look at similar instances where health advocates have tried to promote a particular drug that maybe eventually had issues, people had issues with, they were associated with, drugs in a syringe. So let's run away from that and use messaging that, to me, they are really very contextual, that people can relate to, easily compared to other countries. So, for instance, it would make sense for us to use messaging that would, we cannot use the same messaging in the US, as we're using in Nigeria, because these are two different societies, two different levels of experience, exposure, and all sorts of issues. And I think we think that's really very important, because if you don't do so, you're likely going to encounter some pushback down the line.
Ifeanyi conducted a survey in March 2020 to understand what sort of early COVID-19 misinformation beliefs existed in Nigeria. And he shared with us some key findings from the study.
Some of the responses that we got from the respondents were quite interesting. So from that particular research, that polling that we did, 26% of the respondents said that they were immune to COVID-19. They had some form of immunity to COVID-19. And when we now dug in further to ask why they thought they were immune, you know, you hear things like 40% out of the 26% said, because I'm a child of God. 30% said, because I have strong genes. 17% said, because of the hot weather. 8% said, because I drink strong herbs. While 5% said, well, COVID-19 is not for Africans. And if you look at, you know, how the 26% are disaggregated, you realize that it all boils down to religion. And that, to me, is the biggest threat in Nigeria, whether it's regarding COVID-19 or any other health issue, or even other development and economic issues, even political. Nigeria is a deeply religious country, and it showed in that polling when 26% of the country thought they were immune, and almost half of that 26% thought because, you know, they were children of God. And you can imagine how that would translate into behavior change, what people would do, how they would adhere to, you know, to public health advisories. And of recent, we've had, you know, very influential religious leaders in the country saying they didn't believe in the COVID-19 vaccine. And two of them come to mind, you know, Bishop Oyedepo, that leads one of the largest churches in the country. And also Pastor Chris Oyakhilome, who also leads a very influential congregation. They have come out vehemently to oppose the COVID-19 vaccine, which I think is part of the reason why we have such level of hesitancy, even among health workers, to take the COVID vaccine. A day after Bishop Oyedepo came out with his condemnation of the vaccine, I went to a supermarket in Abuja here to buy some things. And the workers in the supermarket were discussing about this, and they were like, you know, they were using that as the basis to say, look, we will not take this vaccine. It doesn't matter what anybody says, because, you know, Papa has said so.
Ifeanyi also mentioned that, much like here in the U.S., there are some people looking to capitalize on misinformation to turn a quick profit.
There are people with different motives, and, you know, they just thrive in the chaos. So if you have a situation like I read from our research where, you know, people said that, you know, they are immune to COVID-19 because they drink strong herbs. Well, it simply means that people who sell herbs will find that as a good marketing opportunity, you know, to keep marketing their herbs and making sure that people have access to them.
Ifeanyi did suggest that there was a place for religious leaders to help spread quality information about public health issues. It just has to be the right people.
We also have very influential pastors that have spoken for the vaccine and, you know, have really observed all the protocols, all the COVID-19 protocols for their services. So, for instance, people like Pastor Kumuyi, who leads the Deeper Life Church, Pastor Adeboye, who leads the Redeemed Christian Church that is in 197 countries. So, and I think that it is time for us to begin to target such individuals to be the spokespersons. But the ones that are pro-COVID-19 vaccine, also will have scriptures to back up why they believe, you know, people should be careful and take the vaccine.
Ifeanyi also pointed out that spreading good health information isn't just a matter of collaborating with the right leaders, but reaching people using media they're most likely to pay attention to.
Yeah. Ultimately, you know, the usual suspects, TV. But again, if you consider the fact that power supply is still a big issue in Nigeria, so most people will not, even if they have the TV, it's just a box, because there's no power to power it. So we need to find other ways where people can engage people beyond television, you know. And I think social media is key, because I think virtually everybody in Nigeria has a mobile phone. Radio, especially in Northern Nigeria, because that's a very common, if you go to Northern Nigeria, it's very common to see the Hausa man with his radio, you know, even riding his bike and with his radio and his ear, listening to the radio. So we need to look at what are the low-hanging fruits in different parts of the country, in different communities, and really tap into those spaces as early as possible. So, like I said initially, we need to, in designing the right information for people, we need to start as early as possible and involve communities where, and when I say communities, like pastors and people like that, that would usually get some kind of pushback from as part of the design process, as part of the dissemination, you know, meetings that we're going to have. We don't have to wait until people begin to hear the wrong things before we start countering them.
A running theme here is that when you have something as large as the ongoing COVID pandemic, it's not enough to just have public health leaders communicating health information. Of course, you need them to be doing their job well, but you also need people outside the healthcare industry who have access to local communities or large online followings to be a messenger to the public.
It really does need to be a community effort. This is also shown through health literacy research, which proves time and again that trusted community leaders are critical to effective health messaging campaigns.
In our next episode, we'll be talking about manipulative actors, troll farms, and the production of misinformation. So stick around for that. But for now, thanks for listening to this episode of Viral Networks.
Listener-supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn. South of Memphis, Tennessee.